This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Josh Koskoff found a way to legally confront a gun manufacturer for its role in the Sandy Hook mass shooting. In the end, the Remington company settled when the defunct manufacturer's four insurance companies offered to the families all they had left after two Remington bankruptcies that totaled $73 million. Josh Koskoff has become one of the go-to attorneys in a specialty I suspect he would rather see no need for. He'll be in town on Saturday. Josh Koskoff, thanks for taking time from your busy schedule to join us today. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be with you.
You know, your law firm was started by your grandfather in Connecticut. Your father joined the firm and then you did. Your family obviously has deep ties to that state. The Sandy Hook shooting in 2012, you know, must have been an overwhelming shock.
Yeah, I mean, it was. And I think if you think of it as a nuclear bomb, and you know, the closer you are, the more the fallout you feel. And so, you know, we were within the fallout range. Our office is about 30 minutes from Sandy Hook. And I think it's the kind of thing that, you know, any lawyer worth their salt wants to help with when your community is affected in such a horrific way.
How did you wind up getting involved with the nine Sandy Hook families that you wound up representing?
Yeah, well, it was really a matter of, although I was happy to help, it was really a matter of them finding me, the case finding me. It was an unusual coincidence. I was just getting a ride to the airport within a couple of weeks of the shooting. And the driver of the car and I struck up a conversation. He learned that I was a lawyer. He told me that he had a friend who lost his child in Sandy Hook, who was really needing help with all of what was going on. He talked about families whose lives had just been upended and they had a lot to deal with, and asked if I would be willing to speak to him. And it turns out that was the father of the first grade teacher, Victoria Soto. So that's how I got involved. I said, sure, of course, I'll do whatever I can to help. Really, Steve, I wasn't thinking at that point of a lawsuit so much as helping them deal with probate, helping them deal with the issues surrounding the money that came in from the United Way, how the United Way was going to distribute the money, and also just helping them deal with the constant media, you know, pressure that they were under.
You know, give us a sense, Josh, of what the families wanted out of suing Remington to begin with.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, they're nine separate families, and they had their own particular reasons, but I think that they were really joined in one overall purpose, and that was to take their terrible experience and join together to make an effort that wasn't really going to help them so much as that may prevent the next Sandy Hook. That was the one unifying goal, that if they could hold the manufacturer to account, that their manufacturer would change their practices and reduce the risk of other families having to go through what they did.
You said you weren't thinking lawsuit, at least initially. What made you want to proceed then with a lawsuit at some point, Josh?
Well, I knew that after helping the families with their initial issues that they were dealing with and providing whatever assistance myself and our firm could, you know, it was incumbent on us to look at their legal options in terms of potential lawsuits. You know, as you mentioned, I come from a long line of trial lawyers, basically, and we've always had an idealistic, maybe too idealistic view of the law, that the law works best when it works to advance the rights and issues of individuals against powerful opponents, whether it's government, whether it's corporate America. And so it was very much in our wheelhouse to look at potential avenues for these families to gain accountability and the justice that they so deserved.
You know, in the beginning, if you had to give odds on your likelihood of winning this case, what would they have been?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because people would tell me what they thought the odds were and how unfavorable they thought they were. And those were people in my office. but the broader legal community wasn't even as charitable. And I think it was deemed, I never really understood it, Steve, because I didn't have any background in suing a gun company. I didn't know anything about gun law laws, even though I'm a lawyer. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about this immunity out there, and I didn't know much about guns. So I was sort of blissfully, I guess, naive. But, you know, the broader community didn't think there was, they thought there was zero chance. And in fact, there was a lot of pushback about filing the case. And, you know, my feeling at a minimum was if the law is so bad, at least, you know, we can't make it any worse.
Hmm.
So I had this different view.
Well, you're referring to this federal law that was passed in 2005 that protects gun manufacturers and dealers from civil lawsuits when crimes are committed with their products. You know, given that, what did you tell the families going on about their chances of coming out on top?
I mean, look, the families knew from very early on, and even up to the point we filed the lawsuit, and even during the case, that, you know, at least early on, that it was an uphill battle, that we faced a powerful opponent that had managed to get a very favorable law passed to help them become even more insulated, and that many people believed that we had close to no chance. You know, so what I told them is that it was about 50-50.
Wow.
I didn't do that. I did explain to them that I thought that we had a avenue, and that the law really wasn't as bad as it seemed. There was a perception that the gun industry couldn't be sued, and I pretty early on thought that perception was not in keeping with reality. Yes, it's difficult to sue a gun company. But Steve, it's also difficult to sue a pharmaceutical company. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's also difficult to sue a neurosurgeon. I mean, right. You know, the law is replete with difficult burdens and hurdles. And, you know, trial lawyers should be the last people to give up.
So there's this law, again, that I mentioned, a federal law passed in 2005. It's designed to protect gun manufacturers. But there are six exceptions to that protection. Were you relying on one of those six for your lawsuit to be successful, or were you forming a different strategy altogether?
Well, we were sort of going back and forth between the facts of our case and the law and trying to see what worked, right? If you imagine, like, you're looking up at Mount Everest and you're trying to figure out a path to the top.
Right.
Sometimes you just have to start walking and get to a dead end. And you turn around, you go back, you try another path. And so I feel like that's kind of a rough analogy to the process. And, you know, you talked about six exceptions. If you think of them as paths, some of them are really exceptions in name only. So there were two exceptions that we thought met the factual situation that we had and that we felt comfortable going on. One was called negligent entrustment, where people can be held responsible for entrusting a dangerous item to a unstable or risky user. Typically, this would be in the situation, for example, if you give your car keys to a drunk driver and the driver goes out and he runs somebody over, you who have given your car keys and entrusted your car to the driver can be held responsible. So we tried that one out at a grander scale, the concept being that by entrusting AR-15s, which is a military rifle military rifle, it's still being used, by entrusting them to a civilian population, at least as of the time of the Sandy Hook shooting, that is negligent because the evidence shows that just results in, you know, improper uses and the slaughter of innocent people. We also had a theory based on what's called the predicate exception of this immunity, which is basically like the immunity is called the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act.
Mm-hmm.
So by its own name, it doesn't protect unlawful commerce and arms.
Huh.
And so we have a statute in Connecticut. You've got one in your state as well, that governs how people can conduct themselves in marketing their consumer goods. And so we said that they broke this law in Connecticut. That applies to their marketing because they were really targeting underage and young users of their weapon and pushing a criminal use, notably lone gunman mission style assaults, which are criminal in of course, in our other than in the battlefield. So that's the one that prevailed, that they violated a law And the statute only protects lawful commerce, not unlawful commerce.
So to be clear, the 2005 federal law designed to protect gun manufacturers is not perfect protection, not by any means.
It's not, though. What I was confronting with this was this perception, not just by the gun industry, but by my colleagues in the legal community, that it was impenetrable.
Wow.
And you pointed out right off the bat, there are six exceptions. Now, it's true that some of them, again, are not really, don't have any teeth in them. But this, you know, it's interesting, Steve, how a perception will govern, you know, human behavior. You know, a perception will stop people from lawyers from filing a lawsuit. A perception will of strength will get people to capitulate. And I think that one thing I've learned is that this is an industry that benefits mightily from a perception that may be at odds with the reality. And one such perception that might be interesting to your listeners is, you know, I think that if you're like me, before understanding more about the industry, you would have thought that the gun industry was a major American industry, mm-hmm. on par with, you know, tobacco or
right.
oil or insurance or, you know, big agri, big pharma, you know, but it's such a small, tiny industry. It's shocking.
Really?
It is shocking, the scale of this industry as it relates to, for example, the tobacco industry, which also causes a lot of death and injury in our country. It's about 1/50th the size of it. So for every dollar that goes into tobacco, about 2 cents is the gun industry. And of course, it's when it compared to the oil industry, for example, it's less than a penny for dollar. So, you know, the perception is that it's a mighty, powerful, and majorly profitable and highly capitalized industry. It's just not. It's just that it outpunches in terms of the harm and its presence in our lives.
I should point out that Josh Kosgoff will be speaking at 9 o'clock next Monday morning at the 9th Annual Community Forum for Grandparents for Gun Safety. The event is at the Colonial Church of Prairie Village, obviously in Prairie Village, 7039 Mission Road. More information for this event, you can find it at the Grandparents for Gun Safety website. So just to be clear here, you know, has your success in suing Remington, Josh, has it opened the door just a crack to finding ways to impact gun violence in this country when our lawmakers won't create and pass legislation to reduce it themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is that it's opened the door certainly to the legal community and to potential litigants to see that there is another way to hold the industry accountable with the hopeful goal of reducing the catastrophic damage that this industry causes with its practices. So it's been more, and, you know, for example, there was recently a lawsuit filed in Highland Park that piggybacked on our theory here in Connecticut that was successful.
Are you involved in that lawsuit, Josh?
Yes.
Well, yeah,
we represent a family, although we have not filed suit yet. We're a little more deliberate in the way that we do things. Not that they rushed it, but you know, and also Uvalde and Buffalo we're looking at those types of causes of action. And I just think that, you know, the question is, by analogy to other industries that lawsuits have helped bring into, bring public safety to bear as a consideration in how they do business. For example, I suspect that you are, I don't know how old you are, but when I was growing up, cars.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, maybe. But when car, you know, when we were growing up, let's say, you know, cars have become increasingly safer as we get as we move along. And the types of cars and the type of things that I remember my parents used to cart us around in were like death traps. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, it was a series of lawsuits that made cars safer. You know, tobacco, the way tobacco was marketed once upon a time was to, you know, engage children. And that has been significantly curtailed and reducing, you know, addiction and death and costs of tobacco. And so usually the idea is that because these industries are made to bear the costs of the harm they cause, it gives them a free market reason to clean up their operations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you expect a response from a reputable, quote unquote, reputable industry to lawsuits, and that's the way it should work. You know, the X factor here is that the gun industry is not known as an industry that of self-reflection. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't know yet whether or not it's probably too early to tell you whether or not that their skin in the game, the fact that they can be held accountable to the harm they cause, is going to translate into a change in their conduct. However, it may, you know, we hope that it at least gets the folks that are underwrite the industry a reason to pull back the strings. For example, the insurance industry, you know, like all industries, the gun industry needs insurance to operate. Mm-hmm. And so previously it had been felt that, you know, collecting a premium from a gun industry client or insured was a premium you never have to pay out, right? Because that's the perception.
Right.
So I do think that our lawsuit has had an effect on the insurance markets, which in turn ought to affect the way the industry does business. But I think, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
Josh Kosgoff is my guest. He and his team secured a $73 million legal settlement from Remington in connection with the Sandy Hook mass shooting. He speaks next Monday here in town at the Colonial Church of Prairie Village, sponsored by the Grandparents for Gun Safety. So if I have the timeline right, Josh, this suit was filed in 2016. Do I have that right?
The suit was filed in 2014, about 2 years after the shooting. Right. 2016 would have been when the suit was initially dismissed by the trial court.
Huh.
And so we were caught up for many years in the appellate process. So we didn't really get to the discovery of and getting all the depositions and documents and so forth until many years later and actually late 2019, when the Supreme Court of the United States declined to hear the case. So basically, the state Supreme Court here in Connecticut overturned the dismissal and recognized that this claim that we were making fit very, very squarely within that exception that I was talking about, mm-hmm. of where they broke the law of Connecticut, at least by our allegations, in the way they marketed the AR-15.
And so you had to wait 8 years, Josh, and I'm wondering, what's that like, staying the course for that many years?
It is a study in keeping cool. We're trying to keep cool. It's trying to maintain optimism and confidence and to keep the family's head up, you know, as they endure one hurdle after another. You know, but I think the feeling, at least within our office, was, look, I mean, this is nothing compared to trying to move on or trying to pick up the pieces from losing a child in a shooting. And if these families mm-hmm. could get out of bed and go to work and take care of their other kids and just move on in the face of that grief, you know, we could be patient enough to let the process unfold.
Did any of the families at any point ever just want to throw in the towel?
You know, no. I mean, that's one of the, you know, I actually found a lot of strength in them and their resolve. They were so patient, so determined. You know, they had lost so much. And so I think that for them, the case was one way of honoring their lost loved ones. And they think they found strength in that. And we found strength in them. You know, I think if they hadn't have been so determined, if they hadn't had such persistence, you know, I think it would have taken its toll on us as well.
If you had gone to trial, is there anything more that could have been obtained? And I'm not necessarily referring to money here. Had this thing been right. presented at a trial, I'm thinking public acknowledgement from Remington or anything like that, Josh?
Well, I think that, you wouldn't get, I think it's naive. I would like to think there would have been some public acknowledgement, but even when they effectively acknowledged the strength of our case by four different, you know, insurance companies deciding to settle based on what they were looking at that we had discovered, even then there was a repudiation by the industry of the settlement and no accountability. So, But it's a great question. And you know, I always thought that if we got through the legal hurdles that we were going to end up in court. And I think that what I know made the settlement possible is not, as you point out, the money was capped anyway. And it was important that we get all that money because it's important to show that there isn't enough money really to cover the risk and harm caused by a mass shooting like this. But the real linchpin of the settlement was that we were also able to share everything we learned with the public. Had that not been part of the case, we wouldn't have settled. So that part of it is what you would have gotten out of a trial. I think the trial would have, you know, obviously it would have called attention more by the public. But we think that by getting the ability to share all these documents, the ability to share what we learned, that we covered what a trial would have been able to provide, the value of the trial. We felt that was as comprehensive, as ideal a resolution as you could have in a case like this.
So are we anywhere closer today then to seeing the manufacturers of these assault rifles being forced out of business, Josh, just based on the legal actions that are taking place across the country in the wake of so many mass shootings?
I mean, I don't know the answer to that, only that it just seems my only observation would be that of, I think, anybody, which is it's not sustainable for any parts of this equation, what's going on. You know, it can't be sustainable for this industry to do it, to continue to pump out these weapons and to continue to market them to for violent uses and to continue to push them on younger users. You know, that recipe is a recipe for death and mayhem. And, you know, eventually that just can't continue. And it should have happened a long time ago. So, you know, it's either going to require that the industry comes to the table and stops courting risk and starts mm-hmm. trying to reduce it like any other normal, you know, American company, mm-hmm. Or that, you know, it's going to become so too much for the defenders of this industry to defend against any longer. And maybe it's just that the staunchest defenders have to become personally involved by some terrible community shooting or something. Mm. I mean, that'll change people's minds really quickly. I hope that's not the case.
Yeah,
but
right,
no,
right.
It's really hard because we look, you and I look back at this in the wake of all this destruction and death and slaughter of innocent people going about their daily business. And we think this isn't America we were born into. So anyway.
Well, that's Josh Kosgoff, again, the lawyer involved in the Sandy Hook mass shooting, got his family's a $73 million settlement. He speaks at 9 a week from today at the Colonial Church of Prairie Village, sponsored by Grandparents for Gun Safety. Josh, I really enjoyed you having you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
You bet.
Good to be here.
Up to Date is a production of KCUR 89.3. Our theme music was composed by the great Bobby Watson. The program is produced by Danny Alexander, Zach Wilson, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Reginald David. Our engineer is Paul Nakatura. I'm Steve Kraske. Thanks for listening.